Last time I began by discussing mean field theory, and so let me just remind you what it involved. So we said that in the mean field theory, we imagine that each spin is influenced by an external magnetic field plus the field that's caused by the magnetization of its neighbors. And in the mean field theory, we ignore all fluctuations, say that every single spin is doing exactly the same thing, and so the field that a spin feels is the external magnetic field plus the mean field induced by its neighbors. And the mean field induced by its neighbors is nothing more than the number of nearest neighbors times the interaction strength times the magnetization at each of the neighboring sites. And so that defines what I call the effective magnet. The sum of this plus the true magnetic field is the effective magnetic field. And so we have this basic equation. I spent some time last lecture solving this equation. And in the limit where t is approaching, so this is true for t going to tc minus. So what I mean here is t is approaching tc from below. So in this limit, the magnetization has this simple analytical form. And the crucial point about this is that as t goes to tc, the magnetization vanishes, and it vanishes with a square root singularity. So if I were to plot magnetization as a function of temperature, so here is the critical temperature, it's coming in with infinite slope and it's doing something like that. And please also notice that the critical exponent beta, which is defined by here saying that this is asymptotically scaling like tc minus t to the power beta, this beta, the critical exponent, has nothing to do with beta 1 over kt. And whoever invented modern thermodynamics and had this crazy notation that beta is used for two different things, well, he should be, you know, shot. But we're living with this. So okay, that's where what I did last time. So what I want to do today is I want to finish the discussion of the critical phenomena of the mean field Ising model by first discussing the heat capacity. And then I'll discuss the critical isotherm. And again, I'd like to just spend a minute or two just describing like why we even care about the heat capacity. Because, you know, if you just read it in a textbook, it sounds like something very, I don't know, very dorky. You know, like you measure a derivative. You're measuring the heat capacity of constant magnetic field, which is something like dE by dt, the constant magnetic field. Why should we care about this? And the point is that calorimetry was the very first way that people tried to understand the structure of matter. So back in the 1800s, when you only had was the only energy source was fire, what you would do is you would take like a material, you would turn on a fire or a heat source for a fixed amount of time, and you'd measure the temperature difference. And by measuring the temperature difference for a fixed amount of heat involved, you could actually say something about the internal degrees of freedom, because the heat capacity is saying like how much heat can something hold. So if there's lots of internal degrees of freedom, you can hold a lot of heat. If there's not many degrees of freedom, you can't hold much heat. And so this heat capacity was a way, this was like the high energy physics of the 1800s, how to look at the structure of matter at the atomic scale and tell you whether the atom's diatomic or triatomic, was, you know, was there rotational degrees of freedom, translational degrees of freedom, vibrational. All of these things are encapsulated by the heat capacity. And as I mentioned, I think last time, in modern high energy physics, people still do calorimetry, but it's just at a much higher energy level and a much smaller length scale. So anyways, that's why we care about the heat capacity. Yes?
Using this method, trying to understand the internal degrees of freedom of an object,
yes,
is it possible to distinguish between, as you said, translational and rotational degrees of freedom, for example?
Well, it's what's possible to distinguish between the number of degrees of freedom. I mean, the thing is that you probably know that the heat capacity of ideal monatomic gas is 3/2 k, or nk if it's like, you know, if it's the total heat capacity. And if you had like a diatomic molecule, then it'd be like 5/2 nk. And if there was rotational degrees of freedom, it could be 7/2 or 9/2, depending on how many different degrees of freedom there are. So you can't tell like which one is which, but you can at least count the number of degrees of freedom. Anyway, so here, so we have to compute the energy, first of all. And so the energy of the Ising model is a summation over nearest neighbors ij put the minus sign up front, minus j summation over nearest neighbors ij, si, sj. And then we have to do the thermal average of this. So angle brackets always are going to mean average over, you know, overall states of the system. And in the mean field theory, what we do here is we say, well, we're going to neglect correlations between spins. Every spin is doing exactly the same thing. It doesn't matter what anybody else is doing. And so this I'm going to write as minus j summation I j s I s j. So this is the mean field assumption. And so each one of these guys is just a magnetization. And then we have to count how many different pairs of spins are there. And if I have a lattice of n spins, each spin has z nearest neighbors. So I, you know, and the point is that, so in some sense, what I'm counting here, this summation over ij, is counting links between nearest neighbor spins. So I have to just ask how many links are there in a lattice of n spins, and if I have z nearest neighbors. And the point is that each link, you know, so I have, there's n of me, because I have n sites. I have z nearest neighbors, so it looks like n times z, but each link is shared among two sites, so it's actually n z over 2. So this thing is just equal to minus j n m j n z m squared divided by 2. So that's the energy. And so now we can compute the heat capacity. So this is going to be dE by dt. I have minus j n z over 2. So let's forget about that. And then I'm going to have dm squared by dt. And so I just look over at my formula here and compute the derivative here. And so this is equal to minus j n z over 2. And so I have to differentiate this guy. So here I have 3 t over tc cubed times tc over t. So it's 3, this guy squared. So it's going to be 6 t over tc from the first term. And from the second term, it's going to be minus 9 t squared over tc squared. And then there's a minus sign sitting out in front. So in fact, this thing is going to be positive. So this is the behavior for t going to TC minus. And the next place you might be interested in looking at is for t going to 0. And again, if any of you are experimentalists or want to become an experimentalist, oftentimes you look at systems at very low temperatures. And so heat capacity at low temperature tells you something important, especially for quantum gases. Yes?
Sorry, I think it went a bit too fast for me. And on the second line, when you're computing the energy,
here?
Replace the average of the two with the average of the...
This is an assumption. This is the mean field assumption. So this part, breaking up the correlation, this is the mean field assumption.
When you break up the correlation, doesn't it mean that like you're actually not considering interactions? You're saying that there isn't any correlation?
No, I am considering interactions, but the point is I'm assuming that every interaction is like every spin is doing exactly the same thing, so that I can...
Spins are not correlated to it. That's at least that's how I always understood interaction, that like there should be a correlation between the.
Well, I mean, in some sense, they are correlated because this quantity here is non-zero. If the spins were completely uncorrelated, this would be equal to zero. So there is correlation because this two-point correlation function is actually non-zero. But it's just that it's non-zero in a very special way because I'm saying that every spin is doing exactly the same thing. So we all read the same newspapers, we all drink the same thing for breakfast, we all go to bed at the same time, we're all the same. And so that's why it simplifies things. Yes?
Could you also explain to me how you counted the links between the spins?
Yeah, so I mean, the point is that let's think about the square lattice. So, you know, here I am, and here you are, and I want to count like how many neighboring spins, you know, how many pairs of neighboring spins are there. So here there's n of me, and then there's z because there's 4 nearest neighbors. And so I'd say, well, if I then sum up over every single site of the lattice, I would get n times z nearest neighbors. But I'm counting twice because I would count this guy a second time. So someone else had a question? Yes.
How does this step, the mean field assumption of going from the sum over the average of the interaction to the just the average of each spin, how does that relate to the quantity xi that we discussed last time, the difference between the spin correlating function that we...
Well, I mean, last time I talked about what I called the connected correlation function. Connected correlation function, which was something like, you know, S0, SR minus S0, SR. So this I define as like C2 of R, the two-body connected correlation function. So, I mean, the only thing here is that in the case of mean field theory, the connected correlation function would be equal to zero because, yeah. There was other hands, yes.
Does this mean the susceptibility is zero, and why would we be assuming that?
No, the
susceptibility was exactly equal to something like this times a constant.
Yeah, so the thing is that you're right. I mean, in the case, no. So first of all, in the mean field theory, the susceptibility is still non-zero. I mean, we derived that last time, that there is, the susceptibility is how much the magnetization changes when you change the magnetic field. And certainly, if I change the magnetic field, I'm going to change the magnetization. So
the formula you derived was KT chi is equal to the sigma of that thing exactly.
Yeah, so okay. Yeah, you're right. So I wrote some formula like this. KT chi was equal to summation over all R C2 of R.
Yeah.
And so now you can fairly say, so how is the susceptibility non-zero? So all I can, I mean, okay. I'm not sure I have a really good answer for you right off the top of my head. But one thing I would say is that this is an approximation over here. That's a good question. I don't know.
Maybe there is an expectation value of weakness.
What?
Maybe energy.
Yeah.
Expectation value, which is just a product.
Yeah. So this is the average energy. So okay. I mean, maybe I should put average, your thermal average of the energy. Yeah. Yeah. No, that, I mean, I know there's a simple answer, but I don't know it right now, so let me think about that. But thanks for the good question. Keep them coming. Anything else before I go on? Yes.
Yeah, wait. So what's the significance of going from T, like going to TC from the negative side? What happens if you go from the positive side?
Well, from the positive side, the energy will be zero because there's no magnetization.
Oh, okay.
So no energy there. So I'm going to answer that. You'll see in just a moment because I'll plot the heat capacity. Mm-hmm. You had a question?
Yeah, just a quick question about why in the energy we only consider the interaction term in the Hamiltonian and not the
magnetic field part. Because here I'm looking at the heat capacity at zero. First of all, I'm doing it at fixed magnetic field, and this natural case is a zero magnetic field. But yes, you're certainly correct. If I had non-zero field, there'd be another term here involving the field. Okay, anyways, so this is for T going to TC minus, and we can also ask for T going to zero, what happens there? And so the thing is that the average energy, what is this? This is a summation over all states, you know, e to the minus beta energy times the energy of that state. And I'm going to write that sum as basically as low temperature. So when the temperature is really low, then first of all, if the temperature is zero, we're going to be in the ground state. So there's going to be an E ground state times probability of being in the ground state. And then the first term would be the first excited state. So E1 here means the energy of the first excited state times the probability of being in the first excited state, whatever that is, plus dot, 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 dot. And so this is like the appropriate form to have in the low temperature limit. And the point here is that, let's just work something out here. So if I'm thinking about the Ising model itself, what is the first excited state? If all the spins are aligned, the first excited state here geometrically would look like you'd have like a whole bunch of plus spins, and somewhere there's a minus spin. That corresponds to the first excited state. And so the energy difference between the ground state and the first excited state, and because you're going to be only involved looking at derivatives, all we care about is the energy difference. The absolute value of the energy doesn't matter. So we can call the ground state energy, we can call this zero. So let's define this thing to be zero, because it can be anything we want, but let's choose our zero of energy such that when all the spins are aligned, the energy is zero. And then this energy here is going to be increased by equal to zj twice, because every pair of spins which are misaligned has an energy cost of twice j, because, you know, like when I have my spins aligned, when the spins are aligned, so the energy according to this formula would be minus j. When I flip it, then it's energy plus j. And if I define this energy now as zero energy, then when I do this, it's raising the energy by twice j. And I have four nearest neighbors, so the energy, so maybe I should here put delta E. The energy difference is twice dj. So this is equal to energy, so that's going to be 2zj. That's the energy of the first excited state times the probability of making this thing, which is e to the minus beta, the energy of that state. And so that's equal to e to the minus beta 2zj. And so now I can compute the heat capacity, which is equal to dE by dt. And so the only place the T appears is in this thing beta. So this is equal to 2zj e to the minus 2zj over kt. And so when I differentiate with respect to temperature, I'm going to get 2zj. And when I differentiate this object, I'm going to bring down another factor of 2zj over kt squared e to the minus 2zj divided by kt. And the main point about this is as t goes to zero, well, this thing looks like it blows up. But this thing is going to zero incredibly quickly. This is what's called an essential singularity. It's so much more singular than the singularity of this that it overwhelms this guy. And so if I plot now, finally, the heat capacity as a function of temperature in the mean field theory, so here is Tc. And so for very low temperatures, it's exponentially vanishing. And then according to this, it's going to rise up to some finite value linearly, asymptotically close to the critical point. And then above, it's just equal to zero. So this is the mean field heat capacity. Yes?
Counting 2zj and not like 8, because there's four nearest neighbors, like why is it?
No, but the z is the four here. Like z is the number of nearest neighbors. Okay. So yes, you're absolutely right. In the square lattice, it'd be 8. Yes.
When you wrote down the formula for the low energy limit of the average energy, I understand why physically that formula makes sense.
Okay.
But mathematically, what if it's some different functional form?
What do you mean some?
Why can we write it like that?
Well, the point is that when the energy is zero, again, think about what the Boltzmann factor says. The Boltzmann factor says the probability of being in any given state is proportional to e to the minus beta, the energy. So when you're at zero temperature, it means only the ground state is going to be occupied, nothing else. And then as you raise the temperature, you're gradually starting to populate higher states. So the very first approximation to only populate the first excited state.
Why does it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Why does suddenly at t equal to Tc go to zero?
Say it again?
When you reach t equal to Tc, suddenly your heat capacity.
Exactly. And the reason why is because, first of all, the magnetization is identically equal to zero above the critical temperature. If the magnetization is zero, then this energy, average energy above the critical temperature, is identically zero, so there's no heat capacity.
I use this until Tc.
Right. Yeah, and above Tc, I'll just use magnetization is equal to zero. So maybe I should have added here that semicolon m equals zero for t greater than Tc. Okay, so.
What is the heat capacity as T at T equal to TC?
So it's just I have to evaluate this. So that's going to be 6. So it's 3. 3 halves J and Z.
That's not a heat capacity, was it?
Yes, it is. That's what it is.
But maybe the question I have related to that is, why is it not 0? And why do we choose the left value, not the right value?
What do you mean, why do we choose? No, because the heat capacity is a function. This is the temperature axis, and I'm looking at the heat capacity as a function of temperature.
Yes, but we could assign two values, possibly, for the heat capacity at the critical temperature. Either
right.
0 if you're approaching it from the right, or whatever. The
right, value. So there's a discontinuity. There's a discontinuity of the heat capacity right at the critical point. If I'm approaching it from the left, it'll be 0, 0, 0. Suddenly, it'll jump up. If I'm approaching it from the left, it'll rise up, and suddenly go back down to 0. So it's a discontinuous function at TC. That's what it happens to be.
And is there no problem with that?
Why should there be a problem?
I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I mean, there's lots of things in nature that are discontinuous.
What would we measure if we prepared the Ising model at the critical temperature and we measured the heat?
Well, so first of all, if you're talking about a real Ising model, it's not the mean field theory. And so it turns out that in non-mean field theory, the heat capacity has a logarithmic singularity at the critical point. So there's no problem. It's just that in the mean field theory, we have this weird result. The heat capacity is discontinuous. All right. Again, feel free to keep asking questions. These are all good questions. So I want this guy to go down. Okay. So yep.
Mean field theory in the second iteration here, you do not use
it. No, this is not mean field theory, but it's a universal form that the heat capacity of a gas with a finite energy gap between the ground state and the first excited state has this exponential behavior or this essentially singular behavior. So the point is that when you see something vanishing incredibly quickly like this for the heat capacity, that tells you that there's a finite energy gap. And for, if you ever do, if I was giving a full semester course, I would do certainly quantum statistical mechanics, and you learn about Bose gases, Fermi gases, energy gaps, Fermi surfaces, and looking at low temperature heat capacities tells you a lot about the nature of the Fermi surface or in a real electron gas.
Sorry, I have another question. If you look at the first iteration there with the mean field theory, how can you see that it's not zero when T is larger than TC, right?
No, it is zero. I mean, the point is that you remember I showed this plot on my laptop, which showed. And again, let's be clear what we're talking about. We're talking about the spontaneous magnetization, which is the magnetization when the field is equal to zero. And so I plotted, so M is equal to hyperbolic tanh. That's a terrible looking tanh. Beta J. JZ beta M. That was our mean field equation in the absence of an external magnetic field. And what we saw is if I'm plotting as a function of, I plot M, and so the left-hand side is just a straight line of slope 1. The right-hand side is a hyperbolic tanh function, which has two types of behaviors. If T is larger than TC, this is going to come in with a slope less than 1. So this is for T less than TC. And for T smaller than TC, it comes in with a slope larger than 1, so that there turns out to be now two new solutions here, which are the equilibrium magnetization. Okay, so let's just continue on. So the last thing here is the critical isotherm. So let's write again our good old equation. M is equal to hyperbolic tanh of beta H plus beta JZM. And again, the critical isotherm is referring to what happens to the magnetization now as a function of magnetic field close to the critical point. And so close to the critical point, the magnetization is going to be small, just by construction. And if H is small, then again, the magnetization is small. So we're interested is what's happening to the magnetization as I go from positive field where the magnetization is going to be positive to negative field where the magnetization is going to be negative. I'm only interested very close to here. So that means that in this formula, I should be looking at the limit where H is small and M is small. So let's try that. I'll write this as proxy equal to, so I have beta H plus beta JZM. So that's the first term. And then minus 1/3 beta H plus beta JZM cubed. Okay. And so, and the thing is, we're interested at the critical temperature now. So critical isotherm means T equals TC. So T equals TC means I replace beta by the critical temperature, beta C, critical temperature, critical temperature, critical temperature, blah, blah, blah. And so here, beta JZ, that is equal to 1 at the critical point. That's just a definition of where the critical temperature is. So this then becomes beta H plus M minus 1/3 and beta CH plus M cubed. So first thing is that the M on this side is canceled by the M on that side. And so I get that beta CH is equal to 1/3 beta CH plus M cubed. And now, you know, now we have to be a little bit careful, like, which terms do we keep? What's small, what's big? And so, you know, this is one of these things where, and if you read the masterful mathematical physics book by Bender and Orszag in Mathematical Methods, he talks about the method of dominant balance, which is a very fancy schmancy way of saying, well, I don't know, is this term negligible or is that term negligible? I don't know. So let's try to keep just one term, and if it works and it's consistent, I've solved the problem. And if it doesn't work, then I said, well, I made the wrong assumption. Let's see what happens. So the point here is that notice that in this formula, suppose I neglect beta H. Let's see what happens. So if we neglect the beta H term, we'll get that M cubed goes like H, or M goes like H to the 1/3. So if we we neglect this guy, then we're going to get from this that M goes as H to the 1/3. But now, if I make that assumption, then we can come back here and say, well, if M is H to the 1/3, then the term that I threw away, which is the beta H, well, here is H to the 1/3. This is H. When H goes to 0, H is much smaller than H to the 1/3. So it was a self-consistent thing. So in fact, I found the right asymptotic behavior. So the point here is that, you know, this function here is H to the 1/3. From this, we infer that the critical exponent delta is equal to 3. Oops, delta is equal to 3.
Could you say one more time why we neglect the beta CH term, but we don't neglect M? Even
right. So again, the point is that I don't know which, let's sort of be naive about it. Say, I have no idea what to neglect. So let's try, well, first of all, if we neglect this, you get nothing because there's no magnetization anymore. So there's something is messed up with that. So let's try and neglect this term and see what happens. And when we neglect this term, we see M goes like H to the 1/3. And then I have to go back and say, well, what was the effect of the term that I threw away? The term I'm throwing away is H. The term that I kept is H to the 1/3. And H is much smaller than H to the 1/3 as H goes to 0. So everything was self-consistent. Yeah, so that's called the method of dominant balance. So it sounds fancy schmancy, but it's pretty straightforward.
You just said,
yes.
You solve that equation for M because beta CH plus M is equal to 3 times beta CH to the power of 1/3.
Mm-hmm.
And you take the beta CH to the other side. You have,
well, I mean, the thing is that, look, this is a cubic equation. So, in fact, you know, the naive thing, I mean, certainly when I was like at your stage of development, I would say, oh, this is a cubic equation. I'll write down the cubic solution. I'll work really hard.
No, you just take the, you take every side to the power of 1/3.
Say it again?
If you take both sides to the power of 1/3,
okay,
you get 3 beta CH to the power of 1/3 equal equal to beta CH plus M.
Okay.
And M is equal to 3 beta CH to the power of 1/3 minus beta CH. And you can see that if your H goes to 0, you can...
I'm not sure I'm following you. You're saying just, you want me to expand this? Like,
just take both sides to the power of 1/3.
Okay, fine.
First time by 3 and then.
Okay.
Size by 3 and then to the power 1/3.
Okay, so you want me to do this. Okay, very good.
Yeah, and now M is clear what M is.
Yeah, but again, the thing is that now we have to, but the same thing, I still have to check that like this term is small compared to that term.
But
and yes, it's true that M is H to, what?
If you can solve M for H now, you can just say M is equal to the left-hand side minus beta C.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So from this, yeah, I completely agree with you. You're going to find that M is equal to something which is H to the 1/3 minus H.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And then H is negligible compared to this. But the thing is that, so in this particular example, you could actually do it exactly. But it turns out there are other situations where you can't do this exactly. And so dominant balance is the way to go. Yes.
I guess the sort of the thing that's confusing me is when we decide to keep the external magnetic field and when we neglect it. So on that, the top plot for the magnetization.
This is for H equals 0.
That's for H equals 0.
Right.
If we're doing this analysis, we can't do it for H equals 0 because at the critical temperature, the magnetization would vanish and there's no power law behavior.
No, but the thing is that, again, this is the critical isotherm. So this is T equals TC, but H not equal to 0. So as H, we're asking, how does the magnetization vary as I vary H at the critical point? So when H is equal to 0, the magnetization will certainly be 0. But as H is non-zero, I'll get a non-zero magnetization.
Right.
Okay. Okay, so that sort of ends the whole story about the mean field Ising model. And what I want to turn to now is the 1D Ising model. Or Ising model, if I want to be dramatic. And the point is that this is like one of the most useful examples in statistical physics because the model is simple, you can solve everything, you can get a lot of intuition, and it turns out to be a paradigm for so much collective behavior in physics that, you know, Ising lives on, even though, like, it turns out that when he solved for his PhD thesis, he solved the 1D Ising model and found there's no phase transition and basically left physics. And so in the one-dimensional Ising model, the Hamiltonian, I guess let me write it as H minus J summation over sites I, Si, Si plus 1. So here I'm assuming that I have a one-dimensional linear lattice. And so here's site I plus 1. I plus 2, and there is a two-state spin variable at each lattice site, whatever it's going to be. And it turns out, for a lot of reasons, that it's convenient to think about having, if I start at site 1, and here is site n, that it comes around and connects back to site 1. So when these is this so-called periodic boundary condition. And it turns out that, you know, when you're dealing with a finite-sized system, there are two finite effects due to finiteness of the system. One is truly that there's only a finite number of spins in the system, and the other one is boundary effects. And by putting this on a ring, you no longer have any boundary effects. And it just turns out to be a better approximation to the thermodynamic limit than the free boundary condition problem. And it's also mathematically simpler. So this is the one-dimensional Ising model. And so the thing that we want to compute is the partition function, z equals summation over all states, e to the minus, or now plus, beta j summation si si plus 1.
Do we say that n is equal to 1, or do we say n is...
No, n is connected to 1.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's the same, you know, I'm just saying there's a long-range bond, or you can think of this as being living on a ring, so there's a bond that connects n to 1. Okay. So that's what we want to compute this. So let's first do the case magnetic field. Oh, sorry, I forgot the magnetic field here. So summation over, so there's minus H summation over all sites I, Si. So this would be the Ising model in non-zero magnetic field. So this is plus beta H summation over I SI.
Shouldn't the first term have a 2 times beta J because each of the spins is interacting with...
But that's taken care of by the summation. So here it's, you know, 1 interacts with 2, 2 interacts with 3, 3 interacts with 4, and so on.
Then you come back?
Yeah, exactly. So let's first of all look at the solution for H equals 0. For H equals 0, we forget about this term. And now I'm going to do a little bit of a trick. And the trick is the following. Let me define.
Sorry, how did you say that that's 0?
Say again?
How did you cross the second term out?
Because I'm saying let's take the limit. Let's look at H equals 0.
Didn't see that.
Yeah. Let's define the following variable.
Solution to why are
Z, to, say it again?
I don't understand the resolution to Ali's question of why we don't need our Z, why we don't need a 2 up in front.
I mean, this thing is like, you know, so let's write out the first few terms in the sum. So there's going to be...
We're going to have S1, S2, S2, S3, but we're not going to have S2, S1. Like, we're not...
That's right. That's right.
So why don't we multiply by 2 to account for the S2, S1? Or do we not?
No, because, like, if I interact with you, that's the same as you interacting with me. I mean, we don't...
Multiply by 2.
No, I mean, this is just purely... I mean, I'm just saying that... You know, if we're talking to each other, we were talking to each other for like 5 minutes a day. So there's an interaction strength J that says how often we're talking to each other. You don't, there's no multiplying by two there. I mean, it's just how often we're interacting or how strong is your interaction. I can see you're not buying it, but trust me, it's fine. But the thing is, it's an overall factor of two anyways. Yes.
I think maybe it's related to if you go back to larger than 1D Ising model.
Yes.
Or to say that we don't overcount the interactions, we
right.
Should 1 over n.
Yes. No, there's a 1, I mean, there's a 1 half. You know, when I was only, the thing is that I'm only counting bonds. For every single bond, there is an interaction. And so this summation, basically think of a summation over the bonds between sites I and I plus 1, and just summing over each bond.
It should be 1 over z factorial because in the previous parts we have each point has z neighbors and
right.
We don't work out, we have to
divide by 2.
Maybe 1 over z, not one over z.
No, there's no 1 over z. In the case of a lattice with coordination number z, the number of pairs is n z over 2. I mean, and again, like if you don't buy this, please draw like your favorite lattices, triangular, whatever, and check that this is true. Okay, anyways, so I'm going to define a new variable here. Ti is equal to si plus one. And notice that because si is either plus or minus one, there's no other choice. Ti is also equal to plus or minus one, depending on if the spins are aligned, ti will be plus one. If the spins are misaligned, ti is minus one. So this variable. And this is part of the reason why the Ising model is so nice. It's like these variables, binary variables, you make this transformation. And now we've transformed this model into the partition function is equal to summation over all states. So here I had the states Si. Here I'm going to have a summation over all states Ti. E to the beta j summation over I Ti. And there's only one little glitch in all of this, which is that if I take all my spins and flip all of them, then that's a different that's a different state in the S variables, but it's the same state in the T variables because if I flip all the spins, the T's don't change. So there's one more factor of two for that overall factor of two. And so this, now let me write in the following way. Since Ti is plus or minus 1, and the Ti's are all independent of each other, so this is nothing more than the summation of, I can write it this way. I can write this as product over all sites I, e to the beta j Ti. And then there's the factor 2. And again, sorry, I forgot the summation over, you know, ti equals plus or minus 1. And so what is this? It's e to the beta j. So ti can either be plus 1 or minus 1. So this is either e to the beta j plus e to the minus beta j, which is 2 cos beta j. I've got n of these products. And so this is nothing more than 2 cos beta j to the power n times 2. So this is the partition function of the zero field Ising model. Very simple. Part of the reason I'm doing this and introducing this variable ti is that because of the structure of the way the Ising model is formulated, we can actually generalize and think about not just the good old Ising model where every single pair of spins interacts with the same strength. I'm going to generalize to the heterogeneous Ising model. So that is the Hamiltonian equal to summation over all bonds I minus ji si si plus 1. You know, I'm free to define any kind of model I want. So let's think about this, where the interaction strength between each pair of spins is different. And the reason for doing this will become clear in just a moment. So let's see what happens here. Well, if I go back to my solution, so instead of having j, which is everywhere identical, I put a j inside of my sum. And so this would go to ji ti. And so for each term in the product, I have a beta ji. And so the partition function in this case is nothing more than product over all I 2 cosh beta ji, product I equals 1 to n, and then times this overall factor of 2. So we've actually solved a much more general model, the general heterogeneous Ising model with arbitrary coupling strength between each pair of spins. And now you might say, like, why did I do this? Like, you know, why am I making life more complicated? And the reason I'm doing this is that it turns out that for the one-dimensional Ising model, like, the natural way of trying to characterize a system is by exactly the two-spin correlation function. How much, if I have a spin at some site I, or, you know, two-spin correlation function, so I'm going to find C2 of R is equal to the thermal average of S0 SR. So I ask, if I have a spin, here I am, I spin up. Somebody distances R away in the back of the classroom. What is the probability that they're pointing in the same direction as me? That's what this thing is measuring. And so if that probability is almost zero, that means there's no long range order. And if this average is close to one, that means there's long range order propagating in the system. And so this is a natural way of measuring, like, how much magnetic order exists in the system. And the thing about this is that, so let's first of all look at the nearest neighbor correlation function, S0, S1, average value. So by definition, and again, I'm doing this all at zero magnetic field, so this is going to be summation over all states S0, S1, e to the beta j summation over all I si si plus 1 I equals 1 to n divided by the partition function. So that's what this guy is. But notice that if I now generalize and say, let me make, instead of this, so I'm going to be a little bit sleazy here. Please excuse me, just so I don't have to keep rewriting. I'm going to put the j inside the sum and make j arbitrary ji. So I'm going to move the sum out here. So the summation over all ji. And if I make all the j's equal to the same at the end of the calculation, I haven't done anything. So it's just that now the point is that you see that here, when if I were to differentiate with respect to j0, J0 couples S0, S1, and it will bring down exactly the factor S0, S1. So by this little device here, this is nothing more than minus d by d, no, plus d beta j, 0 of the partition function. So you see, if I differentiate the partition function, or I'm sorry, sorry, logarithm of the partition function. So the point here is that if I differentiate logarithm, I'll have 1 over z, and then I have dz by d beta j0, but the only place that j0 appears is the term s0, s1. And so when I differentiate, down comes s0, s1, and I just get my correlation function. But because my partition function is 2 cosh beta j, and so when I differentiate with respect to j0, one of the coshes becomes now a sinh, and everybody else stays cosh. And when I divide by the partition function, all the coshes cancel, and I'm only left with one term, the sinh of beta j0 divided by cosh beta j0 is equal to tanh beta j0. And at the end of the calculation, I make all my j's the same, so it's this. So that is my correlation function. That tells me how much these spins are correlated, nearest neighbor. But I can do a lot more than just that. And again, I'm taking advantage of the algebra of the Ising model. Let's look at what this guy is. This is nothing more than S0, S1, S1, S2, because S1 squared is 1. So I can put S1 squared here without doing anything. S2, S3, I keep doing this all the way up to SR minus 1, SR. And so this correlation function is nothing more than just S0, SR, because all the pairs of SIs, they all are 1, so they all cancel. But each one of these pairs, I can then get by doing a derivative with respect to beta J sub I of this guy. And I now know how to do it when I had beta J0. I just got tanh beta J0. So here, each one of these factors is giving me a factor tanh beta J0, dot, 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 all the way up to tanh beta j r minus 1. And then I say, well, I set all my j's equal to the same at the end of the calculation. And so this is nothing more than hyperbolic tanh of beta j to the power r. OK, yes?
Why are we allowed to split up the correlation function?
Why are we allowed to what?
Why are we allowed to split up this longer correlation function as a product of the smaller ones?
No, I haven't split anything up. All I'm just saying is that I'm rewriting. I'm just inserting inside of here. If I put S1, S1, S1 is either plus or minus 1, but S1 squared, by definition, is exactly 1. So this doesn't do anything.
No, this makes sense, but when going from this larger correlation function to using the tangent, the hyperbolic tangent,
right?
How does that work? Because that's only true for the average over the 2, not the average over all.
No, but so the thing is that, like, to bring down each one of these factors, S0, S1, S2, S3, S17, S18, I just have to differentiate with respect to beta j sub I, the logarithm of the partition function. Each time I do this, I'm going to focus on the one term that has the ji and bring down the factor si, si plus 1. So the product of all these derivatives brings down the right number of factors of S0, you know, si, si plus 1. I mean, let's just do it for like a, you know, let's just do, let, for example, let's do S0, S2. So this is going to be S0, S1, S1, S2. And so what I'm going to argue that this is equal to summation over all states, S0, S1, S1, S2, e to the minus beta summation over all I, j, I, s I plus 1, divided by the partition function. And now what I want to do is say, well, to bring down the factor S0, S1, I should differentiate with respect to J0 times beta plus sign. So this thing, I should do D by D beta J0. And to bring down this factor, I should differentiate with respect to D beta J1, all on logarithm of the Z. Does that make sense? I mean, am I helping or hurting?
Don't you have extra 1 over z's if you do this? Because you have two copies of 1 over z.
Let me do it this way. There's only one copy of z in the denominator. So this each of these derivatives will bring down the right factor of the product of the spins.
But then how do we get to time?
How do we get
to the
product of the time hyperbolics from there.
Well, so at the end of the day, I say all the j's are the same, and you see how many product, how many terms do I have here? It's r terms in the product, so it's beta, tangent beta j to the power r.
No, well, my question is, we have a second derivative acting on z.
Yeah, but these are, I mean, these are like mixed derivatives. This is with respect to beta j zero. This is with respect to beta j one.
And from there, how do we get to the second to last line there?
Second to last.
Zero times all the way.
Well, no. So this thing would be equal to tanh beta j zero times tanh beta j one. Because when I differentiate with this guy, I'm going to, you know. So when I, the thing is again, z is this. Is a product of hyperbolic cauches. Each time I differentiate, I change one of the cauches in the numerator to a cinch. So that's what's happening. Anyway, so I'm almost done here with what I want to derive. So let me define this thing now to be e to the minus r over psi. This is exponential decay in r. And so let me write it this way. And here my correlation length.
Sorry, can I?
Yeah.
The reason why previously can get tanh is because you have every term you have something over z, so the cos the cinch cancels the cos to give you tanh. But now you only have one z.
No, because the cauches are to the end. Like a z is a product of cauches.
Yeah, but overall in the entire.
No, no, but the thing is, so you have a product downstairs is like there are lots of cauches, n cauches. In the numerator, if you do like k derivatives, you have n cinches and n minus k cauches. So all the cauches cancel, and you're left with just the tanh. So anyways, the crucial point, though, is that this correlation function decays exponentially with distance. An exponential decay means that correlations are short range, which means there is actually no long-range order, spontaneous order, in the one-dimensional Ising model. And let's look a little bit more carefully at this thing. So you know, normally when you have like exponential decay, you have e divided, you know, exponential in distance. And so this characteristic length, c, is what's called the correlation length.
Sorry, why tan h beta j to the power of r is equal to the exponential of minus r?
What?
Why is, yeah, why is the, are they?
Yeah, yeah, because this is some number to the power r, which is e to the r times log of this number.
Are there, is there is, oh, that is. The summation of
what? There's no, there's no summation.
That thing is not equal to e to the power of minus r to.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is still one.
Yeah. Here, look, just give me one more second here. So this is equal to log hyperbolic tanh beta j to the power r. I'm sorry. Crap. Minus.
Oh, right.
Minus, ah, minus, there.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, no, I thought it was a constant or something.
Okay. No, 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 no. I mean, it's kosher. It's correct. Sorry. Okay. So, anyways, then so let's look at this guy a little bit more closely. And so, typically, we're going to be interested in the limit where beta j is going to infinity, which corresponds to either the strength is large or the temperature is low. So, in this limit. If I look at tanh x in the limit of x goes to infinity, so this is equal to e to the x minus e to the minus x, e to the x plus e to the minus x. So x goes to infinity, this goes to 1 minus e to the minus 2x, 1 plus e to the minus 2x, oops, 1 plus e to the minus 2x, this goes to 1 minus 2 e to the minus 2x. So anyways, now we go here, and so we're taking the logarithm of this thing. So the logarithm, when x is large, this is small. So log of 1 minus something is just minus that something. And so this goes to, in the limit as t is going to 0, of 1 half e to the twice beta j. So that is the correlation length of the one-dimensional Ising model. So the point here is that correlations are exponentially decaying in distance, which means that they're short range. The range of the correlation is diverging only as the temperature goes to zero. So for finite temperature, no spread of long range order. And presumably you all know this when you were like 8 years old, you would play the game of telephone. Do you know the game telephone?
Yeah.
And you know, if you whisper something I whisper something to you, and we do it whispering. By the time it gets over to here, it's going to be completely garbled if we do it along a one-dimensional chain. Because with one dimension, it's like any little noise in the channel just makes the signal just decay, you know, degrades the signal enough that you get essentially no signal down the end. And this is fundamentally the reason why the one-dimensional Ising model has no phase transition. So I think this is a reasonable breaking point. Yes. Yes, I think this is a reasonable stopping point. So why don't we just take a 5-minute or 4-minute break? Let me just ask, though, would you mind, please, if you could come at 9 o'clock? Because what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go to like 10:35, which means the cleaner is a little bit late. And it starts, it's not fair to Francois. So let's, if you wouldn't mind, please try to come at 9. I'd really appreciate it. So anyway, so I'm stopping for 5 minutes and ask any questions you want. Oops.
So when we compute correlation functions to understand long range order,
right,
correlations,
right,
the quantity we define is insensitive to whether the long range order, for example, in our particular example, if both of the spins are up,
right,
or if they're both down,
right.
Both of those scenarios are counted as the same thing by this
in zero magnetic field. As long as we agree, if we're both Trumpists and we agree, we'll like each other. If we're both like Bidenists and we agree, we'll like each other. It's only if we disagree that we have a problem.
My question is it ever useful? Is there a function that actually distinguishes between both of them being up and both of them being down?
Well, I would say do it at a non-zero magnetic field. Yeah. Yes.
I have two questions.
Yes.
One is a quick one about the heat capacity.
Yes.
Ever a scenario where your maximum is before your TC and then you have like...
No, I mean, in any system that I know about, there's always a critical behavior at the critical temperature. There's typically a power law singularity or a logarithmic singularity, but typically the heat capacity has a maximum at TC, because the point here is that, you know, think about, you know, physically, if I'm thinking about spins, if the spins are easily fluctuating, that means that if I change the temperature by a little bit, that means that that's when the fluctuations are good. I mean, the change in the temperature is going to be the most effective when the spins are kind of already the most susceptible to being changing between plus and minus.
I guess that makes sense intuitively, but mathematically it seems like there should be some peak when, like, you have a balance between the 1 over t squared and the e to the minus 1 over t, right? There should be some peak. So I guess it just happens that that peak is after the critical temperature.
Well, no, but the point here is that, first of all, this was an asymptotic form for t going to 0. That's number one. And number two is that essential singularity kills power law all the time. I mean, basically, you can forget about the power law part because the essential singularity is so much more powerful.
Okay, that makes sense. My other question was about this factor of 2 in the 1D Ising model when you change to TI. I'm
not sure where that comes from. So the point here is that, you know, these TIs, so let's look at the possible states. So we have plus, 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 minus, minus, plus, minus, minus. So those are the states of the SIs. There's 4 possible states of the system. For the TIs, this is going to be plus, this is going to be plus, this is going to be minus, and this is going to be minus. So there's only 2 possible states for the TI for 4 possible states of the SI, but these are doubly degenerate. So that's what the source of the 2.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, think about it.
Times 2 times, not rather a half, but that makes sense.
What?
I'm good, it makes sense. Okay.
Yes.
Just because I missed the argument,
yes.
How we went from the time hyperbolic to the exponential, is it at the limit where j goes to infinity?
Here?
Yes.
No, this is just exact. This is, you know, like, the point is that a to the r, this is equal to e to the r log a. That's all I've done. Yeah. Yes.
I still have a question about the counting thing. So previously, when we defined a Hamiltonian, we had summation over ij, and there's no, like, I and j. You could have a case where I equals to 1, J equals to 2, and I equals to 2, J equals to 1.
No, but okay. I see where you could be confused. So when I write IJ with the angle brackets, that's meant to be a summation over all nearest neighbor pairs, counting once and only once. Yeah.
Well, what was the physical meaning of correlation length?
Just like how far the correlation spread. Like, you know, like I, you know, you're close to me, and so we might agree on something, but, you know, to ask somebody like out in Northern Ontario, what are we talking about? Do we agree with the person in Northern Ontario? Well, there's...
If you look at this positive half, that was the... And when beta goes to infinity, which means t goes to zero, your correlation length
diverges.
Infinity, so everything is correlated with anything else, so that you can't actually say nearest neighbor approximation holds?
No, no. The point is that as the temperature goes to zero, the correlation length gets longer and longer. And at zero temperature, all the spins are aligned. So there is spontaneous magnetization at T equals zero, but only at T equals zero. So that's what's special about the one-dimensional Ising model, is that it has no long-range order except at zero temperature.
Are we assuming that infinitely many spins?
Yeah, so I'm always talking about, you know, I'm always thinking in terms of the thermodynamic limit. So, you know, the number of spins is going to infinity. Is the average magnetization zero or non-zero? Yes?
Connected to this, so you said the reason why there is no phase transition in one-dimensional Ising model is any disturbance
yes.
is strong enough to disrupt everything.
Exactly.
Because there's only one way the information can...
Exactly.
How does the picture change when you have the 2D Ising model?
So that's going to show up in next lecture, because I'm going to tell you about the so-called Pyrrhos argument, because maybe I'll just start lecturing now. I mean, the point is that, you know, this one-dimensional Ising model has no phase transition in one dimension. So Ising, submitted his thesis to Wilhelm Lenz. I have no idea what they said to each other, but, you know, it's like failure. No phase transition. I'm leaving physics. You know, I failed. And so for about maybe 6 years after his thesis was proposed, people were still thinking, well, there can't be any phase transition in higher dimension. And then Rudolf Pyrrhos, who also won a Nobel Prize at some point, came up with this thing called the Pyrrhos argument that showed that there is a phase transition in greater than one dimension. And that rekindled the interest in the Ising model and culminated with, like, then there was a duality argument by Kramers and Vanya in 1937, who calculated the exact critical temperature on the square lattice. And then Ansager solved the 2D Ising model and became legendarily famous in 1944. And then since that time, lots of people, mostly crackpots who have not been able to do anything, have tried to solve the 3D Ising model. And now we believe, for good reasons, that you cannot solve it. But anyways, that's going to come next time.
Sorry, I said real quick.
Yeah.
Will we discuss the solution, like the analytic solution of the 2D Ising model?
Say it again?
Will we discuss the full solution?
No. Sorry. No, the thing is that, look, the thing about the exact solution of the 2D Ising model, when I was a graduate student, I was infatuated with it. And there's this very well-known book by Barry McCoy and T.T. Wu called The Two-Dimensional Ising Model. It is an incredibly mathematically beautiful, well-crafted book. And to my taste, it is like exactly the wrong thing to be looking at, because it's so sophisticated, it's so fancy schmancy to say, this is like where it's at. This is like real physics. But this is just working out mathematical, complicated mathematical details that, you know, they worked out the correlation function along the diagonals or along the Knight's move diagonal. I mean, okay, fancy, wonderful, but like, so what can you do with it? So I really caution you, like, I was infatuated with this as a graduate student, and I knew how to solve it. I knew, like, all the stuff with the, you know, Pauli matrices, the 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix, how to diagonalize it. It's all beautiful. It's all beautiful mathematical physics. But beware, because you can fall into, like, this sort of almost cult-like trap. Sorry. Sorry to burst your bubble. Okay. So anyway, let's now go to the, I can go up here. So now that I've solved the, what's going on here? When is this? Scroll. Manual. Oh, there we go. Front. Okay, so what I want to now talk about is the case not H not equal to zero. And so again, our Hamilton, well, let me just write the partition function. So z is equal to summation over all states e to the beta j summation over nearest neighbors si, si plus 1. And again, because it's nearest neighbors, there's only, everybody has only two nearest neighbors, we can do a sum over each site, just si times si plus 1. And then I have plus beta h summation. And now I'm going to do a little trick that's essentially doing nothing, but it turns out it's going to be very useful. I'm going to write this as summation over I. I'll put a 1 half here. And I'm going to write it as si plus si plus 1. So you see, I haven't done anything. I've just made it more complicated. But the point is that this now has two indices, I and I plus 1. And as we're going to see, this is how you can define the transfer matrix, which allows you to actually solve this thing. So notice that, so I can think of this as T, I plus 1, right? Because it's just a two-index object, so let's just call it T, I plus 1. But notice that when I'm, if I think of each Ti as a 2x2 matrix, because what is I? I refers to the state of the ith spin, which is two states. I plus 1 refers to the states of the I plus first spin, which also has two states. So this guy is a 2x2 matrix. And so if I look at Tij, you know, there's plus plus, plus minus, minus plus, minus minus. And I just have to write out this object when the spins are in the state plus plus and so on. So this is equal to, so here I'm going to have e to the beta j plus, and so if it's both plus, so this gives me 2, it cancels 1 half, plus beta h. If they're both minus, then this also, if they're both spins are minus, the two minuses cancel. I still have e to the beta j, but I have minus h over here because I now have two minus signs which cancel the half and give me a minus sign. And in the off-diagonal elements, if it's plus and minus, this goes away. And here I'm going to have e to the minus beta j and e to the minus beta j. So that's my transfer matrix that essentially tells me how to connect state I to state I plus 1. And then notice when I'm summing over all spin states, if I'm summing over a particular spin state of, say, the ith spin, that might refer to the first element of my matrix, which is like the row elements, but then it's like the column elements of the previous entry. And I'm doing that over everything. And if I go all the way around the circle, then I'm just multiplying this matrix over and over again until I get to the very end. And then since the first guy connects to the last guy, this you can convince yourself. And so I'm not going to, you know, just write it out yourself, like if you want to really convince yourself, or like a chain of length 2 and length 3 and so on, that this is nothing more than the trace of the nth power of the matrix. So this is trace of t to the power n. So that's the partition function of the two-dimensional Ising model in a finite magnetic field.
Trace of t all to the power of n?
Trace. Yeah, so it's the trace of the nth power of the transfer matrix. And the thing is that, you know, from elementary linear algebra, you know that if you want to compute the trace of the nth power of a matrix, like the simplest thing to do is to first diagonalize it. That doesn't change anything. It doesn't change the trace of the matrix. So this is nothing more than, this is going to be nothing more than, when I diagonalize this, there'll be like a large, there'll be two eigenvalues. And, you know, again, because this is a simple 2x2 matrix, you can work out what are the eigenvalues of this matrix. There are two eigenvalues, call them lambda plus and lambda minus. Lambda plus will be larger than lambda minus. So, you know, we'll have eigenvalues lambda plus, which is larger than an eigenvalue lambda minus. So when I take the trace of a diagonal matrix to the nth power, it's just going to be lambda plus to the n plus lambda minus to the nth. I forget about the lambda minus to the nth. And so this goes over into lambda plus the power n. So that's my partition function. So again, you hide a lot of stuff here because you have to first compute what the eigenvalues are and then take the nth power of it. But it's all just simple algebra. And so I'm going to just not do any of that algebra and just going to tell you what the answer is. So lambda plus is equal to e to the beta j cosh beta h plus or minus the square root of e to the 2 beta j cos squared beta h minus 2 hyperbolic sinh of beta twice beta j. Yes.
Sir, oh. Is there meaning to this matrix, or is it just a definition so make our life easier?
Pardon me?
Is there a physical meaning to this matrix, 2x2 matrix, or is it just something that we define to make our lives easier?
Well, I mean, again, the point is that we want a sum. We're calculating a sum over all states of some complicated function, and it's just that, in some sense, if you think about this geometrically, you know, you start here and you sum over the states of spin one, and you have some algebraic expression that you then have to sum over the state spin two, and so it's like you're transferring your way down the chain, and that's why it's called the transfer matrix. But yes, it's a very useful construct because that's how Onsager solved it in the two-dimensionalizing model. Here, for the 1D Ising model, each spin state, each site has only two states. But if you think about a square lattice like this, n by n, then if I go like sort of column by column across the lattice, then you have n spins here. Each internal state is like 2 to the n possible states. And so the matrix he diagonalizes is a 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix with a complicated algebraic structure, which required some state-of-the-art techniques to figure out. Yes?
For the transfer matrix, it looks almost like a linear combination of the Pauli matrices.
Yeah.
Is there a way to...
That's basically how, Onsager solved. I mean, in the case of the 2x2 matrix, it's so simple. We don't have to worry about making anything fancy. But in the case of the two-dimensional Ising model, using, some group theoretical ideas is what made, Onsager able to, like, actually solve his problem.
But is there a way to see how that could be?
Pardon me?
Okay.
By the way, if you want to be, depending on your perspective, you can either be incredibly inspired or incredibly depressed. So if you read Onsager's original paper, it's quite amazing. And then in 1951, Onsager solved for the magnetization of the 2D Ising model. And at a meeting, he just wrote down the answer and said he didn't show how to do it. And it was unpublished for about a year and a half until T.D. Lee, of Lee and Yang, who won the Nobel Prize, he solved for the magnetization. And so he has a paper in Physical Review, like in 1951 or 1952, where he solves the magnetization. And this calculation is just, holy smokes. It's like, what the hell is this guy doing? It's like, it's amazing. And then he writes at the end, I'd like to thank Bell Labs, for giving me a summer internship so I could work on this problem. It's like, oh, it's just a homework problem. So the guy was just, amazing. Yeah. Okay. So let me just get my papers together here. Yeah. So the only thing I want to say here is, let me now, the only one last thing here is the magnetization. Let's compute the magnetization per spin, which is the total magnetization divided by n. And so this is equal to, okay, so let me write one more thing here. So z is equal to lambda to the n. And from this, the free energy is equal to minus nkt log lambda plus. And so finally, the magnetization, which is this, so this is equal to 1 over n df by dh. And so if you do this calculation, again, it's everything here is completely straightforward. So trust me, if I'm skipping a step on something straightforward, I really do mean it's straightforward, and I just don't want to waste time like screwing it up. And so what you get here is hyperbolic sinh of beta h divided by the square root of sinh squared beta h plus e to the minus 4 beta j. So that's the magnetization. And so for the guy listening in the back, if you could make the screen go down for just a moment, it might be helpful. Let's see if that happens. Because the thing that I just want to show is I want to plot the magnetization as a function of, thank you for the, where does this? All right, so hopefully, I mean, this is actually not a terribly sexy plot, but it's just worth showing, I guess. So, is it detecting my, yes it is, great, excellent. Okay, so here again, I did a simple mathematical plot just showing the magnetization as a function of, here's magnetic field, here is the magnetization, and you see I have some slider bars here, so I have zero, J is equal to zero, so no interaction, so it's the paramagnetic model, and I have temperature equals one, just for the sake of argument. I chose one temperature, and I'm asking, how does the magnetization change as a function of the interaction strength? And the point here is that, well, nothing very much interesting happens. Notice that when the magnetic field is zero, the magnetization is zero. Now let me turn on some strength, coupling strength between spins. And all that happens is you just pull this point where the switch happens, it gets to lower and lower temperature. But the crucial point is that at zero magnetic field, no matter how much I crank up the interaction strength, the magnetization at H equals zero is equal to zero. So this is the no phase transition of the one-dimensional Ising model. No matter what the interaction strength, the magnetization at zero field is equal to zero. So poor Mr. Ising, he did his thesis, it was a very nice calculation, but it turned out to be not helpful. And so that was the end of his career. Yes?
I find it very difficult to believe that if the coupling goes to infinity, there wouldn't be long range correlation.
No. So if the coupling goes to infinity, so let's just do that. So here I only went up to J equals five, but that's pretty large. It's much larger than the temperature. So this is effectively coupling equals infinity. And so you see that the magnetization is one, one, one. It's all one until the magnetic field goes down to zero, and then suddenly it goes to zero. So you'll have long range order, except when the magnetic field is very small. And the crucial point here is we're interested in the spontaneous magnetization when there's no magnetic field. Okay, you can raise the, raise it, thank you. Okay, so let's see, where am I now?
Why are we interested in spontaneous magnetization?
Well, because that's sort of like the interesting collective behavior. You know, again, the idea in statistical physics, I mean, if you think about like what we learn in statistical physics, you start with thermodynamics, then you start with ideal systems, the ideal gas, the ideal paramagnet, non-interacting systems. And the interesting point is that people starting in the early 20th century noticed that there exists phase transitions. Ice melts. You know, a ferromagnet, a bar magnet loses its magnetization when you heat it up. Like, what causes these things? Like, how
do they notice that ice melts?
What? Well, I don't know when they notice that. Yes. But the point here is that, you know, given the emphasis on the early development of stat-mech on ideal systems and non-interacting system, the question was, how do interactions give rise to a phase transition? How can it be that I change the temperature by 0.001 degrees and you go from having no superconductivity to superconductivity, or no magnetic order to magnetic order? These were like really fascinating questions in the middle part of the 20th century.
So when Ising or Ising proposed this model and looked at the...
Lenz proposed the model, Ising worked it out.
Sorry?
Lenz proposed the model, Ising worked it out.
Okay.
That's his thesis advisor.
Okay, when Ising solved this...
Yes.
And saw that for zero magnetization, for zero external field, you have zero magnetization.
Right.
Why was he exactly, he wanted a magnetization, a non-zero value for the magnetization?
Yeah, so this was first proposed as a model for a phase transition. And, you know, so there's a lot of hope when he was first working on it, because maybe this is a model for a phase transition, and I'll find a phase transition, then I can book my ticket to Stockholm. but he found no phase transition. And so for about 6 years after the fact, people believed that, well, this Ising model is useless because there's no phase transition. It was only until Pyrrhos, which I'm going to outline momentarily, showed that, in fact, there was a phase transition at non-zero temperature. So before the Ising model, the only model for a phase transition was the van der Waals theory, which in some sense is the most successful theory of phase transition because it's like such a simple model. It predicts a phase transition. But no one had a microscopic model.
Should have probably got a Nobel Prize.
What?
Ising?
What, van der Waals got a Nobel Prize?
Yeah, I mean,
oh, Ising.
Should have probably got a Nobel Prize as well.
Well, maybe an Ig Nobel Prize would have been better.
Really?
I don't know. Okay, so what I want to do in the remaining time is I want to talk about the Pyrrhos argument, because that's a really
Can I ask one more question?
Oh, please.
So you said the trace can just be, you approximated the Poisson function by the positive eigenvalue.
The largest eigenvalue.
The largest eigenvalue.
Right.
What is the magnitude of difference between the plus and the minus eigenvalue?
Oh, well, it depends on the temperature, but say one is 1.5 and the other is 1 1/4, for example. But you raise it to the nth power, n is 10 to the 23. Forget about the smaller one. So again, we're always interested in the limit large n. Okay, so so what we found now is d equals 1. There's no order, no spontaneous order. We found that in the mean field limit, there exists spontaneous order. So it naturally begs the question, like, when does spontaneous order first appear? And so Pyrrhos came up with this argument to show that, in fact, spontaneous order happens in all dimensions above 2 and above. And so this was a really important result, because even though, as you can see, the argument is almost trivial, it refocused efforts in trying to understand two-dimensional magnetism and led to Ansager's exact solution. By the way, I'm going to tell you a story. So Ansager is Norwegian. Maybe you knew that. Maybe you didn't. He spent many years at Yale University. He was a mathematical genius. He came during the Depression, and you know, he was a chemistry professor, but he didn't have a PhD. And so at some point, the faculty said, you know, you've got to have, you know, a PhD to teach here. And he said, well, you know, I have these notes on the Mathieu functions, which are some fancy schmancy mathematical physics functions. And the people looked at it and, you know, could barely understand it. But obviously, the guy was a genius. And so he got his PhD and could continue to teach at Yale. And he used to teach the advanced statistical mechanics course at Yale University. He was known as a terrible lecturer. Really terrible. He could not sort of do a single sentence. So his two courses were known as Advanced Norwegian 1 and Advanced Norwegian 2. So, okay. Anyway, so the Pyrrhos argument.
Wait, didn't he get like fired from somewhere for bad teaching, or was that?
Say it again?
Didn't he get like fired from somewhere for bad teaching, or was that another guy?
I don't know. He was certainly not fired.
Wow. He was a different guy.
Was he kidding?
Okay, never mind.
Okay. Yeah, tell me who you find. So here's the Pyrrhos argument. And so I'm just doing like the absolute simplest thing, because I want to just capture the essence and not worry about mathematical details. So let's first of all apply the Pyrrhos argument for d equals 1. So the idea here is he wanted to ask, like, suppose I'm in the ground state. If I create the first excited state, a little localized bubble of spins that are misaligned, what is the energy cost of this? What is the entropy that's associated with this? What is the free energy of this first excited state? And is it lower or higher than the ground state system? So let's imagine we have one dimension. We have all our spins plus. So I'm now using plus signs and spin spins up because it takes less effort. And now here's a little bubble of minus, and then spins are plus. So let's ask ourselves, Can this spontaneously happen at some non-zero temperature? And so the point here is that the energy cost for making this bubble So there's a misaligned spin here, a misaligned spin here. The energy cost is equal to 4j. And only 4j. It has nothing to do with the system size, because all I have to do is have two spins. You know, I have to have basically a domain wall here and a domain wall here. And so let's call this bubble, say, of length L. And so the cost for the energy cost for a domain wall does not depend on the size of the domain. It just the fact that there's two walls means that there's an energy cost of 2j for each wall, an energy cost of 4j. Now let's ask for the number of states that are available to the system. And in this argument, I'm going to focus my attention. I'm going to say, let me just look at a bubble. So here is my, you know, here is observer. And ask, can I, you know, where I'm looking at the lattice, can a bubble magically appear? And I'm just, now I want to ask, like, how many ways can I make a bubble of length L such that I'm an observer and I see a bubble of length L? Well, clearly that bubble can be anywhere here, length this way, L this way, or this way. So there's L possible ways that I could have my observer, or there's L different ways that the bubble can occur such that if I'm an observer at a fixed point, I'll actually see the bubble. So the number of ways is like proportional to L. So the change in the free energy of the system, delta F, which is delta of E minus TS. So this is going to be delta E, so that's 4J, minus temperature, K temperature, times S, times log L.
But is it proportional to L if we assume, what, that the observer is in the same spot, but that we could shift the...
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the bubble, it can be anywhere. I just want to ask, like, if I'm just looking here at my lattice, I'm saying, do I see a bubble or not? And that's all I care about. So, but the point here about this is that notice that at any finite temperature, eventually this, you know, for there'll be an L large enough such that this thing will be less than zero. So this will be less than zero for any t greater than zero if L is large enough. So that means that eventually, if I'm looking at my little, you know, I'm an observer somewhere in the lattice, a bubble will appear. And that means that the ground state is unstable to formation of a bubble, which means no magnetic order. Yes?
Sorry, I think I missed. Why again is omega equal?
So the omega is the total number of states available to the system. And here the number of states is the number of ways that I can arrange this bubble such that it overlaps with the observer. And so there's L possible ways that I could put this bubble such that it's going to overlap with the observer.
But if the observer wants to understand that's a blob.
What?
If the observer wants to know that that's a blob, it has to have information about the rest of the...
No, I just, you know, I have my, no. I don't care about the rest of the system. I just want to know, is there like an excitation where I am at? Will that happen?
How would you know it's an excitation? How would you know it's the opposite spin of the rest of it?
Well, no, I mean, like, I'm not thinking of experimentally measuring this. I'm just saying that what is the probability that, or what is the change in free energy if such a bubble exists? Does that raise or lower the free energy? Yes.
But if, and one of the different ways of arranging the minus signs in such a way that the observer sees them, for example, if I just push it off to the
right,
the left a bit, the energy would not be 4J anymore. The observer would not know.
No, the energy is always 4J for one bubble. The energy cost does not depend on anything else. It only depends on the fact that there's a domain wall here and a domain wall here. There's nothing. There's no other contribution to the energy.
What if there's external energy?
Well, but the thing is that that's not the interesting case, because we're interested in spontaneous order at zero magnetic field. Because if there's a field, there will be order. We're interested in spontaneous order. Okay, so look, I've got, because we started 5 minutes late, I've got one more minute in my 5 minutes late. And if you want me not to go 5 minutes late, please come on time. But let me now just talk about D equals 2. So D equals 2, what's the analog of elementary excitation? It's a little bubble like this of perimeter L. I guess that's a very appropriate because we're at the Perimeter Institute. And so here we have minus spins and it's surrounded in a sea of pluses. And now I want to ask, what is the energy cost of this bubble, delta E? So that's basically 2JL, because wherever I have a pair of spins on either side of this interface, I have like two spins misaligned. That energy cost is twice J. So I have twice J times the length of the perimeter. And then the other thing here is, like, well, how many different ways can I create this bubble? And roughly speaking, you can think of this thing here as a self of, do you know what a self-avoiding walk is? Have you guys heard that term before? Some of you have. It's basically a path that doesn't cross itself. It's called a self-avoiding walk. And so the path here is a self-avoiding walk that has to come back on itself. And it's well known that the number of paths of length little l, so the number of paths scales as some number, I don't know what to call it, lambda to the power l. And so if I now compute the free energy difference, and I'm going a little fast here because I just want to get to the end of this before my time runs out. So there's going to be 2JL minus KT L log lambda. And the crucial point here is that in one dimension, there was only the L dependence here. And so when L got large enough, this would necessarily be negative. Here, L appears both in the same places, so it doesn't depend on L. And so now the temperature does play a role. When the temperature is small enough, creating a bubble, if this goes to zero, creating a bubble will cost free energy. If the temperature is large, then you minimize the free energy by creating the bubble. And so this implies that there is a TC greater than zero, maybe exclamation point. So that is the Pyrrho's argument, and then it can easily be generalized to higher dimension. But the main point is that there is phase transition in two and higher dimensional ferromagnetic systems. So that's my end. Yes?
Could you say again why the fact that it minimizes for the 1D case, that it can be less than zero, means that that state is not favored?
That's right. So because the thing is, you're always trying to, because, you know, from basic that mech, we learned that the free energy is a thing that you try and minimize in thermodynamic equilibrium. So we're trying to minimize it. So if I can lower it, that's good. Right, the free energy is a minimum in thermodynamic equilibrium. So if I find another, if I start with a ferromagnetic state, I create a bubble, and I find I can lower the free energy, then thermodynamic equilibrium says I should go to that state because it's lower free energy. Okay, I'm done. Yeah, so yes, ask away. By the way, don't begin your questions with sorry, because nobody should be sorry.
How you got that matrix again?
Well, first of all, you see here that there are two indices. So we can call this thing Ti, Ti plus J. But the point is that when we sum over spin states, you know, let's look at, say, spin 61 and 62. And so I have T 61, 62. But then when I sum over the spins of at site 61, I have to go plus and minus. And then for 62, the same thing. And so it's like everyone has precisely this structure to it. And again, like if you feel a little bit shaky with this, work it out for two spins, three spins, and just see, like, and so these are the kinds of things you should work out on your own to really get it in your DNA. Yes. That's right. So the number of self-avoiding paths of length L, you know, so this number L, lambda, somewhere between 2 and 3. Because clearly, if it's only 2, you can't make a circle anymore. And if it's, and 3 is more than enough, because like 3 is like a non-backtracking random walk. Like if I start here in the square lattice, in principle, I've got north, east, west. There's three choices. But some of those choices will lead to self-intersection. So that means that lambda should be less than 3. Well, no, so lambda is some number. It's like, no, but the thing is that the thing I want to say is our control parameter is temperature. So if the temperature is really low, then, you know, forget about this term, if temperature is low enough. And that means that the free energy will go up when I create a bubble, which it doesn't want to do. On the other hand, if the temperature is really large, then this negative term wins out. And so that means that it's favorable to create bubbles. So that means that there's a finite temperature that demarcates where bubbles are disfavored to where bubbles are favored, which is the existence of a phase transition.
Why wasn't the same case there as well? Like there, we could also say.
But you see here, the thing is that in this particular case, L appears in both places in the same way. So like it doesn't matter anymore. Yeah. Okay.
But why, how do we generalize the argument for D equals 1? Because this is true, like your delta F will be negative for any T, yes, but only if L is large enough. So
right.
What happens when L is small enough? Like you would be incentivized to...
No, but the thing here, all I'm just trying to say here is that if for a large enough L, I can find an L large enough such that I can lower the free energy by creating a bubble. That's the point.
Oh, and then the system will do that.
What?
Okay.
Okay. Go ahead.
Here, best lambda, lambda should work. Depend on L, right? The
number. No, lambda is just some number that depends on the structure of the lattice. And so this number lambda is, you know, lambda is less than 3 and bigger than 2 for the square lattice. It's just, I forget what the number is, but it's...
Okay, so it's close.
Yeah, it's about 2.63. Yes.
Can you do this in higher dimensions?
Pardon me?
Like the same argument, but...
Yes. So the thing is, like in 3 dimensions, now you have a spherical bubble. And so in that case, the energy cost will involve the surface area. But then it turns out that, you know, so this will be surface area, but then this term also have the same dependence on the size of the bubble. So this argument... It's more involved in higher dimension. That's why I'm not showing it, because it's just a lot more, you know, rigmarole to like get to the same point. But the issue mainly is that in one dimension, the first excited state, it costs no energy. And so it's very easy to get to the first excited state. In finite dimensions, the first excited state has a finite energy gap. So you have to do some work to get to it. Okay. Wow. There's no cleaner. Poor Francois, I feel badly for him. Yes. What?
They're waiting outside to make sure.
Oh, so they should come in. Yeah.
This number of paths, you said it's a self-avoiding walk.
Yes. Self-avoiding loop. Yes.
Maybe it's slightly up. 3-3. It's connected from what we're doing, but what is the rough argument that lets us see that it's some constant? Why?
This is a whole other story, like how many self-avoiding walks of length n are there, and so that's a whole other story, but the point is that the number of walks grows as exponential in the number of steps in the walk.
Okay.